Well, hello everybody, and welcome to the 55 East Investment Revelations podcast. I'm Nigel Pope, your host, and today we have the pleasure of speaking with Charles Monchot. We are sitting in his lovely offices on the Sheikh Zayed Road and with a view in the distance of the Arabian Gulf. Charles is a CIO and Head of Investment Management at Al Mal Capital in Dubai. He's a former investment banker, having attended University of Geneva, HEC, MIT, and the Instituto de Empresa in Madrid. He holds the following qualifications: CFA, CAIA, CMT, and MBA, which are some of the highest in the field of investments. Charles, welcome, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Nigel. Thank you.
So let's get right into it and start by referring to a recent economic report that you published. And in it, you mentioned that you had seen strong returns across all asset classes. And then you go on to mention that, confronted by weaker economic data, risks to trade outlook, and still low inflation, central banks came to the rescue by opening the door to further monetary stimulus. Can we infer from this analysis that it's your view that central banks have single-handedly created the conditions for the continuation of this bull market? And if so, is it your view that central banks ultimately decide the fate of most investments?
Yeah, so that's a very broad topic, but it's very interesting to look at what happened over the last 2 years. So you have 2018, US economy was strong, earnings decent.
Yeah.
But the Fed had to hike rate twice, and they decided to normalize the central bank balance, the Fed balance sheet. And guess what? 90% of the assets were down, especially equities, correcting sharply in Q4. Okay, so that was 2018. Then 2019, we have exactly the opposite situation. The US economy is getting weaker. We almost had an earnings recession.
Yes.
Close to 0%.
Yeah.
But the Fed decreased rate twice, and they started to increase the size of the balance sheet again. And guess what? We have a very strong rebound in most asset classes, very strong year for US equities, and we have more than 90% of the asset classes being up. So that's exactly the opposite, and I think it's a bit, too simplistic to just summarize this as the action of central banks, but definitely they played a huge role.
Yes, yeah. And perhaps Trump plays a bit of a role as well with his banging the drums of lowering rates and the Fed to get on the case.
So it became, now that the markets are kind of being used to that, in the sense that when he's pounding on the table and when, let's say, the trade war risk is increasing, there is, let's say, the hope that the Fed will come to the rescue. And you can look at, we are end of November, you can look at last week. We had a few, let's say, negative news regarding trade war with this Hong Kong bill, for instance. But the market, didn't move that much. But on the other hand, the expectations for a red cut next year certainly increased. So we move from less than one red cut next year to between one and two. Just because the market started to price in that if the trade war risk is increasing, then there are hopes that the Fed will interfere to kind of offset these negative effects.
Yeah, so on that basis then, the outlook so far would look pretty good then for the next few months, 6 months, 9 months, I suppose, in that regard.
I think, the way we summarize it is hope for the best and prepare for the worst.
Yes.
So what could be the best? The best could be that thanks to all of, the monetary easing that we have seen this year, and this is not just the US, by the way, because we have 60% of central banks around the world decreasing rates. That's the highest percentage since the global financial crisis back in 2009. So thanks to all of this monetary easing, we should see some kind of, let's say, pickup in growth next year, especially emerging markets. Developed markets will stay weak, if not slightly weaker, but emerging market growth is expected to turn around. So if we do see that, we can expect some improvements on the manufacturing side, and the consumer is expected to stay strong. So that could be, let's say, the ideal scenario of, let's say, still, you know, reliable consumer strengths coupled with at least some stabilization on the manufacturing side. So that's the best case scenario. And if this scenario happens, we should see improvement in earnings growth and potentially a broader, let's say, participation to the upside, because the last few years has been very much US led.
Yes.
And we might see, you know, some pickup in, let's say, non-US. Okay, so that's the positive one.
Yeah.
Now, as you know, I mentioned, prepare for the best, hope for the best and prepare for the worst. So what could be the worst? The worst is that we live in, let's say, very, let's say, debt bubble environment. Mm-hmm. So any, let's say, bad surprise could re-hit global growth. What could be the bad surprise is that we are again, you know, going through some kind of, let's say, a false start for manufacturing growth, and that manufacturing stays weaker, if not weakened, you know, even more. And in that case, it can pull in its decline the consumer. And then if you have both the consumer getting weaker plus manufacturing seeing a recession, then you get to the, let's say, the scenario of a full-blown, let's say, you know, economic weakness, if not recession.
Yeah.
And then you need to prepare your portfolios, you know, for that kind of, let's say, scenario.
Yeah. Okay. And in your quarterly report, you cover 10 major title stories. I'd like to highlight some of them that I find particularly intriguing and relevant in today's economic environment, and ask you to elaborate on them. The first in particular comes to mind is that central bank policy is all that matters. We've covered that a little bit already. But you say that the path for risk assets is becoming narrower, but maintain a positive stance on risk assets, and that late cycle expansions are often associated with elevated equities valuation, tight credit spreads, and financial excesses. Do you think we're seeing financial excesses at present?
Okay, so here the way I would like to tackle this is to kind of, let's say, weigh in the positive and the negatives of all of these, let's say, central bank leadership over the last 10 years, basically.
Okay. Yeah.
In a very, in a summarized way.
Since Bernanke.
Yeah. So basically, to be fair with central banks, is that if they hadn't intervened back in 2008, and also in 2011, you know,
yes,
with the whatever it takes from Mr. Draghi.
Crisis. Yeah. Yeah.
Probably would have gone through, let's say, full-blown recession, you know, 1929 style. So obviously, you know, it would have been very bad for global economic growth, earnings, and so on. So I think they made, let's say, their they added a value there, as just to quote Mrs. Lagarde, you know, 2 weeks ago when she said that it's better to have a job than higher yields on your saving accounts.
I think
that's a first statement.
Yes.
Obviously, you know, they have participated to lower, you know, to a very, you know, large extent, bond yields. Thanks to lower bond yields, we do have, let's say, higher equity multiples. It also helped the share buyback, and this has been a very strong, let's say, help for
yes,
earnings and for the market. And also, it had a positive influence on sentiments. Because, you know, again, there was this whatever it takes, which probably saved the
yes,
Eurozone.
Yeah.
And then there is a sense of Fed put that we just discussed before with, you know, trade war risk, then the Fed comes and so on.
Mm.
So that these are for the positives. Now there are a lot of negatives. And you know, we don't know exactly how this could, let's say, develop going forward. So let's talk about the perverse effect. Is that been these central bank action have been more deflationary than inflationary. We know deflation is not great, especially when you have a lot of debt, because
yes,
when prices are going down or do not go up and you have a lot of debt to redeem, that's not great. Massive leverage. The 2008 crisis was about over leverage. If we look at the value of global debt 10 years ago, it was $200 trillion. Today it's $270 trillion. So that's a massive increase.
Yeah.
So here the cure hasn't been great. Moral hazard. If you look at governments, will it be in the US or in Europe, they are not, let's say, inclined to do anything else than just relying on central banks. So they keep printing money, they keep borrowing fix things instead of reforming. So that's an issue. Misallocation of capital. Think about all of the let's say, easy money going to the Silicon Valley.
Yes.
Think about also all of these zombie companies. There are a lot of zombie companies which are able to survive just because interest rates are so low that they can still, you know, kick the can down the road. Income and wealth inequality. I think that's a big theme.
It's huge. Yes,
totally. It's huge.
Yeah.
And as you know, this is leading to the rise of populism, also to protectionism. And it's kind of, let's say, you know, vicious cycle is that, you know, the more QE we have, the more inequality we have, the more political issues we have, and the more central bank needs to step in. So we are within this cycle. And the worst is addiction. Because we started to discuss about 2018, 2019. So basically, the 2018 was a test to see how the Fed can normalize the balance sheet of the central bank.
Mm.
And guess what? It failed. How they are solving this?
Yeah.
By doing more QE, basically, because wants to name this QE4. They call it technically
the repo. The repo.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, what is the new name for it? It's technical QE. Is the last one I heard.
I hadn't heard that one.
So that's the issue with let's say addiction, is that they cannot stop, and we don't see, let's say, new policy coming. There was a kind of, let's say, fiscal stimulus story in the US, which has created some envy in other countries. Like, we start to hear in Europe that they want to, quoting Mrs. Lagarde again, I think it was 1 month ago, when she said that she would like to see Germany and Netherlands, the two countries with current account surplus, starting to invest. So that was a call for us. Please stop monetary, monetary policies, and let's try something else.
Yes.
So let's see. So again, there are some perverse effects,
yes, absolutely,
which basically are creating also a kind of
vicious circle.
Vicious cycle. Some worries for deciders. Would they be on the political side or on the corporate side?
Mm.
And this is probably why we have this business cycle, which is very different from others, which is very long in time.
Very long.
But also very, let's say, the slowest in terms of amplitude.
Interesting.
Because growth keep disappointing.
Yeah, yeah. So as you say, it's been a very long and protracted period of growth, but it's been very drawn out. Yeah. So maybe we have a couple more years left at this rate.
It's already, let's say, beating the record in terms of longevity, but it might indeed be very long. One of my former boss at Deutsche Bank called it the turtle cycle. Why the turtle? Because it's very, very slow.
Yes.
It's a cold blood, the blood being inflation, so very low inflation.
Yeah.
But the turtle is not a bad animal. It's
that's true.
It's kind of a nice animal. Yeah. The only thing is that it goes very slowly. But this animal can still reach target. So we can have a cycle which is not, let's say, that bad, which is very long. But again, with these very specific features of being very slow and with very low inflation.
Yeah, yeah. I like the points that you touched upon, actually, and particularly the vicious cycle, because that then leads away from economics and into the general welfare of the population. If we carry on doing the inflation and the money printing, then... And it leads to misallocation of resources, which the Austrian school talks about, and we have the political issues arising, populism and nationalism, which you mentioned. Okay, great. So the next story I'd like to cover is negative yields and the global yield curve inversion. We've got around $13 trillion in negative yielding debt. I think it's mostly Germany, France and Switzerland.
And Japan,
yeah. Okay. I mean, we've got negative mortgages in Denmark for consumers. Where do we go from here? Well, what do you think?
Well, yeah, the negative interest rates, as mentioned before, it's creating a lot of, issues, mentioned like, over leverage, more as our misallocation of capital, as you mentioned. For the time being, we are not at a stage where, the retail or mass markets investor is getting charged negative interest rates on his or her bank accounts.
Yeah.
We're not that far away. I know that in Switzerland, for instance, from 2 million Swiss franc, you start to get charged, you know, negative interest rates. So we're getting there, but
yes.
I think it's improbable to see, let's say, deposit below $300,000-$200,000 equivalent to get charged, because then it start to really create, let's say, very broad issues. But you know, one thing that needs to be, because you mentioned some vicious cycle, we can name another vicious cycle, which is an issue for all of us, which is pension.
Yes.
So if you take pension funds, so take the US, which is not in negative yields for the time being, but which is in, let's say, very low yields.
Yeah.
You look at the pension system. So now you have the situation where the returns are so low that is creating a widening funding gap, and the companies, they need to, you know, use their available cash to bridge the gap.
Right.
When they use this cash, instead of investing into productive assets, in capex, investments, hiring people, they use this cash for the funding gap, which obviously put a cap on economic growth. And because economic growth is not as much as expected, you have more quantitative easing, more Fed action, which is again lowering the yields. So this vicious cycle has been going on for 10 years now, and you have widening funding gap for, you know, vast majority of US companies and so on. But you can apply this to Europe as well. You can think about the effects on the insurance companies. So there are a lot of, let's say, side effects coming from the ZIRP or NIRP policy.
Yes, I do like these acronyms actually. Yeah, so we've got the Austrians came out with their 100-year bond. Was it a month ago, something like that, maybe two months ago. Why is there so much demand for it?
That's the crazy thing, is that, well, you know, to summarize it, we are in a very weird situation where the capital gain is made on very long duration bonds. So you have speculation that yields can only go down.
Mm.
So you find indeed for 1 year AAA bonds a lot of demand, because you have investors betting on, let's say, even, you know, lower yield down the line. So they buy the bond for price gain.
Right.
At the same time, when you look for yields, investors start to buy defensive high dividend yielders equities to get the yield, to get the 4 or 5% yield. So that's the, let's say, very tricky situation. But to your point, let's say if you look at the pension funds demand for that kind of yield, is basically they have very long liabilities, and they are matching this with very long duration assets.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, it looks, let's say, very counterproductive to purchase assets where you are almost guaranteed to lose money.
Absolutely. I mean, are these pension funds, are they mandated by their own sort of rules and regulations that they have to invest that money there in the bonds, or do they just say, well, we need AAA, we've got to have AAA bonds in the portfolio?
Of course they have rules, and if you take, for instance, solvency rules in Europe, this is also a characteristic of some of the insurance companies, where basically they need to buy a huge amount of sovereign bonds, whatever the quality. So this is why, you know, we have a company, let's say Italy, for instance. We know that Italy is struggling.
Yes.
In terms of where they stand in the business cycle, they are, you know, we can say, in recession and for some time. They have huge debt loads. I don't think that, you know, it's very appealing to invest into the bonds of an issuer which is debt to GDP of roughly 130%.
Right.
But still, they offer very low yields, and they find demand. They find demand from most of the, you know, European insurance companies, which are forced to buy sovereign bonds. So this is what when I referred to this, you know, moral hazard issue before.
Yes,
is that you have this very tricky situation where, you know, there is this huge debt load that needs to be matched by demands and by regulation. European governments, because they have no other way around, they force, let's say, some of the, you know, the participant to the financial ecosystem to buy these bonds by imposing some very strict risk rules. So that's the very, and again, no, it's at least it helps to maintain the cohesion within Europe to save the Eurozone.
It does. Yeah.
But that's a short-term fix. It doesn't solve, let's say, the long-term issue, which is if you have a lot of debts, you need growth. Without growth, you know, it becomes very tricky.
I suppose the growth tends to come, demographics plays quite a large part in it as well with growth. Europe doesn't have the demographics.
This is an important point, and interestingly, it is the case of most of the, let's say, debt laden countries. Think about Japan, for instance. They have huge debt loads.
That's right.
Very demographics.
Yeah, and their population, it's like a mushroom.
Yes.
Very interesting. Now, I liked the title of Dr. Copper is diverging away from the S&P 500 equity bull market by about 35%.
Yeah.
I've not heard that one before. What's it telling the market, and why should we be concerned?
So copper has been very good, at least in the past, at leading the economy, not the equity market, but the economy. So in other words, when you have a strong copper price, that means that the global economy is going to do well, and the other way around is true as well. So this is why some have said copper deserved a PhD title, and this is why we should name copper Dr. Copper.
Yeah.
I don't think it has been as true recently, and maybe there is one reason for this, is that maybe copper is very much linked to the manufacturing side of the economy and not so good at predicting what is happening on the consumer side. And if you look at the global economic growth pie, where it's coming from, so you have obviously China is very important, 17%. Yeah. So you can find some correlation between what is copper doing and what the Chinese economy is doing.
Mm.
But the number one contributor to global growth is US consumer, just 1% above China. So I don't think it's very easy to find any, correlation between US consumer and copper. But as mentioned before, in the case we see further deterioration on the manufacturing side, there is always the risk of, let's say, some negative consequences of, let's say, this weakness in manufacturing affecting the US consumer. That's a risk. So this is something that needs to be very closely monitored. But yes, Dr. Copper has not been, let's say, very bullish about global economy recently, but for good reasons. We know we can see that global trade is disappointing. Manufacturing has been very weak. We have seen recently some stabilization on the PMI side, which could indicate that there could be some, let's say, light at the end of the tunnel.
Mm.
But again, we are not sure about that. So this is why I like to look at Dr. Copper.
So Dr. Copper gives you an idea, and not a major indicator or a major indicator?
I think it's worth having a look. It's just like, I think there is, it would be too easy if there would be one or two indicators being, let's say, systematically right about what will happen.
Yeah.
And I think this is why financial markets are so interesting, is that
there's no one answer, is there?
Yeah. No one has found, let's say, exactly the magic formula at this stage. Or maybe some huge quant systematic hedge funds like Renaissance,
well,
but it's still very very difficult to use, let's say, indicators in a systematic way and be right, based on their message.
Yeah. So I'm more of a stock market single stock guy.
You're right. That's much better.
And I noticed you wrote about small caps and the large caps diverging in value. Can you elaborate on why that's happening at present, and why the smaller, let's call them value stocks, why are they lagging? Is this a late stage cycle event or phenomenon? What do you think?
So I think this probably came as a surprise, because if you look at the global context, so you have a let's say domestic economy in the US is, because here we're going to talk about US large cap versus US small cap.
Yes.
So
yeah.
In the US, domestic economy is doing reasonably well. So you have, very, low jobless rates, wages are increasing by 3%, consumers are doing okay. So it looks like the domestic economy is doing reasonably well. And then we know that the issue is on trade, export, and so on. You have the dollar, which is strong.
Yeah.
So these are the kind of, let's say, characteristic of, favor U.S. small and mid-cap at the expense of U.S. large-cap. And guess what? Mm. It hasn't happened. U.S. large-cap have been outperforming massively. And it's true that if you aggregate, for instance, the margins, so the profitability of large-cap versus small-caps, indeed large-cap deserve to trade at a premium to small-cap. The only thing is that the premium is huge. This is the largest premium since 2003. So we're talking about 16 years. Okay.
Yeah.
So is there a trade there? I think among the reason behind the strength of large caps, there are two main reasons. The first is the outperformance of some of the tech mega cap.
Yeah.
So think about the FANGs. Yeah. The FANGs are kind of distorting, let's say, the S&P 500 story.
Yeah, good way to describe it.
Okay, Apple, Amazon, Facebook, Netflix. So these are and also Microsoft. They are definitely distorting the story on the large cap. And the other distortion factor is the fact that the defensive stocks have been doing very well, and they are more represented in the S&P 500 than on the small caps. So think about utilities, for instance, which have been doing well this year because investors are looking for bond proxies.
Mm.
So they bought utilities, they bought REITs. All of these stocks, they are more heavily represented into large cap than in the Russell 2000.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, I like your idea about small caps because I think we might see some interesting rotation as long as global economic growth, improve.
Mm.
First, cyclical and value stocks that are really lagging because you mentioned small cap value. So these are, styles which are really lagging. So you might see some catch up, some rotation there. And also what is interesting with small caps is that when there is, the US rates going down, they usually benefit. Why is that? Because the sensitivity to the construction sector is three times the sensitivity of the large cap.
Right.
So usually decreasing rates, they help construction sector.
Yes.
And the SMEs, or let's say at least the small and mid caps in the US, they benefit from this effect more than the large cap.
Right.
So I think, I will tend to be in sympathy with what you mentioned of, allocating to small caps. I think that's probably a good idea.
Yeah, I would go along with that, actually. Yeah. Okay, great. Following on from that, we were going to the precious metals. Gold is back is the title of the next headline. Your technical analysis chart shows classic breakout to the upside on gold over the five-year period. We know there are many advocates for a return to the gold standard or even a more modern version of it. As for 50 years, we've been operating on fiat monetary system anyway. But do you put the case for gold merely down to the expectation that the Fed will be continuing to keep rates lower for longer? And if so, how would you suggest investors hold their gold portfolio, ETFs, physical, or futures?
So on the first point, so yes, gold is back, and actually it's very rare to have in the same year double digit performance for the S&P, double digit performance for at least on the annualized basis for long duration bonds, and double digit performance for gold.
That's phenomenal.
It's phenomenal. It's very rare.
Yeah.
And here, I think what is also difficult to understand is that usually gold performs well in two extreme scenarios. One, which is the kind of, let's say, recession scenario. So you buy gold to kind of be on safe.
Yes. Yeah.
Or hyperinflation, because you need to go back to out of fiat currencies into the, let's say, the gold standard.
Mm.
And we are neither on these two scenarios this year. We are not seeing recession, maybe a bit of recession risk, but no recession. Obviously, very far away from hyperinflation. So what's going on? So first, obviously, with interest rates being negative or zero in many countries. So holding some gold makes sense because you don't suffer from, let's say, the opportunity cost of not having a yielding asset. So you like gold. Okay, that's the first one. Two. I think despite the fact that the equity market is making new highs, sentiment by investors remain negative.
Yes, it's funny that, isn't it? Or rather bizarre.
Yeah, so it's negative. So they are holding gold as a portfolio diversifier, which might be a good idea, by the way. I agree on this.
I also agree.
And then the very important factor is central banks buying a lot of gold.
China and Russia.
China, Russia, but also some emerging market countries. Oh. Why are they doing that? Because take the example of Ukraine, for instance. Mm. Ukraine, you know, they are in trouble, so they need a loan by the IMF. And the IMF, they want, you know, some collateral when they are, you know, lending some money. Yeah. So what they ask for is, okay, I want the loan to be collateralized by, you know, an asset, which is a kind of hard asset, but liquid enough to be sized, you know, or transferred in case of. So this is why you see these, let's say, buying spree of gold by central banks. And actually, there's an interesting chart on this showing that there is a high correlation between the two, which is explained, you know, very nicely by the regression analysis. And then back to your last point regarding how to be exposed.
Yes.
So first, yes, we recommend our clients to own some gold in portfolios for the, let's say, prepare for the worst.
The insurance.
Yes, the insurance I mentioned earlier. Obviously, you know, ETF / ETCs is the easiest way. Mm. But then I will recommend two things. If you use ETF, is first to buy a physically backed ETF, not swap based.
Okay.
Because swap based, you don't know what can happen.
That's right.
And two, go with strong issuers. Because, you know, if you own some gold for, let's say, end of the world scenario.
Yes.
In the end of the world scenario, if the issuer is a bank, you don't know exactly what can happen with this bank.
That's right.
So I think you mentioned during your question about physical gold, if you really believe in some kind of, let's say, gold is the ultimate insurance,
yeah,
then maybe you need even to own some physical gold with the number, you know, attached to it and held into a very, let's say, safe vault in somewhere in a safe country. I'm not naming it.
Yes, and the older I get, in fact, the more sort of cynical I become about having, if I can hold the asset, I want to hold the asset. And something like gold, which is more of an insurance policy, the end of the world, if you like, if there's, you know, should we ever get there?
Gold miners could be interesting as well.
Very true. Yes.
Gold miners, because they have been underperforming massively over the last 10 years because of different reasons, you know, oversupply. Also, when you buy a gold miner, basically you're long gold and you are short oil, because oil is one component of their cost base.
Right.
Because they need energy to dig and so on. So if you think about scenario where, you know, demand for oil is collapsing because of, let's say, recession, then you have oil going down and you will have gold going up for, let's say, safety reasons. So you have here the perfect long short, which is leverage through the gold miners. So having a bit, obviously much more volatile than gold, but gold miners can be also interesting play.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of it like that as a long short, gold against oil with the miners. It's very interesting. Now, one of my favorite topics, Bitcoin, and I'm very impressed to see it in your quarterly report. You mentioned it had reached above 12,000 in mid 2019, and now, as of today, 5 months on, it's approximately 50% lower. I mean, a lot of the macro, US macro fund guys treat it very seriously because it's totally uncorrelated, as far as I'm aware, to anything else that's out there. Do you agree with that view? And secondly, what do you say to your clients about Bitcoin? And what is the case for or against?
Yeah. Well, first, it's very interesting to see the dichotomy of views within the financial industry. So you have many, asset managers, wealth managers, bankers, who basically do not want to hear anything about Bitcoin. They believe it's a scam or it's a fraud or it's useless, it will go to zero and so on. And then on the other hand, you have some, indeed some very serious players who are indeed paying attention to it, and not only paying attention, but investing massively. Think about Fidelity, think about Goldman. So here we're talking about massive investments, let's say across the value chain. So we'd be, you know, being able to store, custody, you know, cryptocurrencies, being able to trade it, being able to manage it long only, long short, and then also everything which has something to do with blockchain, where which can, it's a long, maybe another topic, but which can really revolutionize the financial industry. So I'm in the camp of, at least, you know, we need to, I think people need to get educated about it, and need to consider it as an investment, because it's, at the end of the day, it's an investment.
Yes, I suppose it's, I mean, I was looking at the stock to flow. I don't know if you've seen stock to flow analysis by Plan B on Twitter. His Twitter handle is at $100 trillion. And he's an econometric analyst at one of the Dutch firms. And he's done his own analysis on Bitcoin and stock to flow, in conjunction with Safety Namus's book, The Bitcoin Standard, his work. And he's come out with some very interesting analysis on where Bitcoin should be. I can forward it on to you if you haven't seen it, but from an econometric point of view, I mean, he's done a regression analysis. It's about 99.5%. Very interesting. I don't think there's any other financial product out there like that.
I actually went through it, and what I like about this model is that it, it's, if you look at Bitcoin, there are basically, to me, two, let's say, possible use of it. The first one is store of value. So before we talk about gold, so this is, to me, the digital, ultimate digital gold. Why is that? Because there is limited supply and potentially increasing demand. And even though some, let's say, many commentators say, okay, well, it's, no, the valuation is insane and so on. Here, if you compare the current value of Bitcoin, we're talking about $130 billion. And let's say the global value of money around the world is more than $83 billion. So it currently is 0.1%. So if indeed this is a store of value, it can be interesting. And the other use is programmable money. So here it's more about, let's say, infrastructure, network. It can have some value, it can have no value. That's more difficult to assess, but let's see. Coming back to the store of value and the stock to flow analysis. So here, what I like to start with stock to flow analysis, to just come back on what it is. So stock is the outstanding supply of any commodity. So think about gold, silver, or Bitcoin. We know what is the current supply. So that's the stock. And then flow is the amounts entering every year the market. So if you think about gold, there is a stock to flow ratio of 62, which is, you know, among the highest in the world. Why is that? Because, okay, there is already, you know, a large inventory of gold, but actually there is not a lot of, let's say, new flow coming in every year, so we can calculate this value. If we look at Bitcoin at this stage, it's roughly half of this value, so it's around 27. Okay, but we know that with Bitcoin, there is a halving process. So in May 2020, the new, let's say, flow coming to the market is going to halve. So suddenly, the stock to flow will jump to around 56. So 56, we are nearly at the same level than gold. And then where it comes indeed very interesting, as you mentioned before, is that if we look down the line, like in 2024, for instance, the stock to flow ratio is going to reach 100. And as you mentioned earlier, if you look at the charts and you compare the different store values, would be so gold, silver, palladium, and then Bitcoin. Indeed, if Bitcoin follows this regression analysis, here I prefer not to mention the kind of prices see down the line.
Yes.
So coming back to how to use it in the portfolio, because here we're talking about investments.
Yes.
The simple rule I usually apply is that the higher the volatility of an asset, the lower should be the sizing. So I like Bitcoin for exactly the features you mentioned earlier. So decorrelation is nothing to do with the other asset classes. And indeed, it can go to zero, but it can also massively appreciate. Especially think about two things. One is indeed, you know, broad adoption of blockchain.
Yeah.
Or two, these, you know, MMT scenario, you know, modern monetary theory,
yes,
where suddenly there is massive printing. So here you need a store of value.
Yeah.
So in these two cases, you have massive upsides. So how do you play that into a scenario, into a portfolio? Very low size. You put 0.5%, 1%. If it goes to zero, worst case, well, you know, it can happen with, if you have 20% in stocks and the stocks, you know, decrease by 5%, you lose 1%.
Okay? Easily.
So here it can be sized at 1%. You keep it. And then let's see. So that's the way I look at it.
Yes, yeah, so I suppose with the volatility, you have to keep the size lower.
Yeah.
But the asymmetry of the bet is such that, you know, any big payout is going to be multiples of what you've put down as your risk.
The other way to play it, and I've seen this with some newly created hedge fund strategies or systematic, you know, multi-strategy hedge funds, which have different sets of systematic strategies, non-uncorrelated with each other, is that they are playing the inefficiencies of the market because it's a very, very inefficient market.
Yeah.
So there are huge price discrepancies between exchanges, so you can go long one exchange, short another exchange, or there is also very high LT, you know, you can charge very high lending rates on Bitcoin.
Yeah.
So there are multiple strategies which are very uncorrelated, or totally uncorrelated with the asset class per se, where you can generate, you know, very attractive returns. So we start to see smart money going into that kind of, let's say, arbitrage strategies.
Yeah, very good. Well, it's a brave new world, isn't it, really? So there's a lot to look forward to by the sounds of it. Charles, I know we're going to have to bring it to a close. It's been truly a fascinating discussion.
Thank you so much.
I want to thank you very much for your time, because I know you're a busy man. And it's good to see, it's given me a real insight into how the larger institutions have to cope with position, profit, and protect themselves in the financial markets. So thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Hopefully you'll join us again sometime.
Thanks. Bye-bye.